Thank you. My name is Brooke, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, JD and Irina, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Tiffany will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Tiffany, and I'm an alcoholic. Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Tommy will read the steps.
How you doing, Tom, alcoholic? Jesus Christ. 12 steps. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Jessica will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Jessica. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of tonight's meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, the first of which will speak on the fifth tradition, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker to share on the fifth tradition is Michael.
Jeff Rossman usually fixes my collar every meeting. Actually, I should mention that. So you failed at a job. My name's Michael. I am an alcoholic. And, you know, I'm doing a talk on the fifth tradition, which is really quite remarkable, because I'm going to spend 10 minutes not talking about me, which is evidence that Alcoholics Anonymous works. And, you know, it's very important. The fifth tradition, in short, is what will guarantee AA's long-term survival. And for those of you in this room that are new, and for those of you that have been here a while, the significance of this tradition may have eluded you. And that might be because you haven't done homework on it, both the history of AA and the tradition itself. And I want to encourage everyone in this room, after I am done and in the future when you go home, to spend your time doing some homework on the traditions. And go to GSO's website. You can even contact them, ask them for information, which is what I did. And the reason I opened with that is I contacted GSO before I did this talk, and I said, what would you like me to tell this group? Because it's not my message. And it's not even boils down to this message. It's Alcoholics Anonymous's message, and GSO represents us at that level, which is above the individual and the group. And I don't mean above in a hierarchy level. I mean it's the way they think about everything is the long-term survival of Alcoholics Anonymous. We here just have to worry about the survival of our group. So needless to say, I'm going to read something. It's going to take about 2.5 minutes. I prayed for all of you before the meeting, and I prayed you'd be able to, for a miracle, I prayed you'd all be able to listen. And I believe that it will work. This is from GSO's 1988 conference, and after this, their 2004 final report from the 54th annual meeting of the General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it talks about Tradition 5. Tradition 5 states that each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. When a group honors Tradition 5, it communicates the spiritual principles of simplicity and purpose. And as Bill sees it, he writes, this is why sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the teaching and practice of AA's 12 steps, is the sole purpose of the group. If we don't stick to this cardinal principle, we shall almost certainly collapse. And if we collapse, we cannot help anyone. In our groups, now this is the end of the quote, end quote. In our groups, we must communicate that message to every newcomer and even to the not-so-newcomer who thinks that our meetings are dumping grounds for drug talk, relationship problems, spending, and everything other than alcohol. It is our responsibility to help those persons learn about and understand our single purpose, and, if necessary, we should help them get to the appropriate program. Always remembering that love and tolerance is our code. In the language of the heart, Bill writes, how well we need to heed the principle that it is better to do one thing supremely well than many things badly. He goes on to warn us the temptations to do so will be aplenty. The Grapevine Tradition Checklist asks the question, do I ever cop out, and this is for each of you individually, by saying, I'm not a group, or this tradition, for that reason, doesn't apply to me. The concern, as individuals, we have to make a difference in our groups by sticking to recovery from alcoholism. At a workshop recently, and this is an incredible story, so I'm going to read, this is why I'm reading it. At a workshop recently, this woman is telling the story. A young woman shared an allegory about the King of Denmark. It seems the king one day went out alone, on horseback. A visitor to the country was surprised to see the king unattended, and asked one of its citizens, does the king have bodyguards? The citizen replied with pride, we are all his bodyguards. Each member of AA who sticks individually to our singleness of purpose becomes part of the citizenry of bodyguards who communicate and protect our fellowship. Our literature table has only conference, excuse me. Now this describes her home group, which actually reflects this group incredibly well. My home group, she says, communicates our singleness of purpose. Our format includes the primary purpose card, which is read at many of our meetings, Atlantic Group meetings. We ask that all who participate confine their discussions to their problems as it relates to alcohol. Our literature table, which in this room is on your left over here, has only conference-approved books and pamphlets. We point newcomers to other local meetings that stick to recovery from alcoholism. Sponsors communicate our single purpose to one alcoholic sharing with another how they got sober through the 12 steps. All of our literature, but especially the big book, The 12 Traditions, The 12 and 12 Daily Reflections, and the AA Group pamphlet communicate our singleness of purpose. PI, corrections and institutions, all of these things communicate our singleness of purpose. Whenever we take a meeting into a correctional or treatment facility, our responsibility is to make certain that the message we carry is recovery from alcoholism through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The client, the inmates, they might share about other substances or issues, but as AA members, we share only about our alcoholism. Now, you know, a lot of confusion exists about this, and I actually have an opinion. And, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about that opinion. And the reason isn't because my opinion is important, but because I think it's going to kill people. I've overheard people in AA refer to alcoholism and drug addiction and food and all of these things as the same. And so they think that that means that alcoholism is the equivalent of, and that if they can just say, I have a problem, I'm an alcoholic, whatever it may be. Now, the fundamental problem with that is, unless individually we surrender to each of our conditions, we can't do a perfect first step. And without a perfect first step, an admission of complete powerlessness, we will end up drunk. And so this illusion that addiction in general, which comes from rehabs and institutional facilities, is a reflection of what Alcoholics Anonymous believes alcoholism is, has no business here. And the reason it has no business here is because we have one purpose, and it is to help the alcoholic recover from alcoholism. It is not to solve all the alcoholic's problems. Now, I could have introduced myself today as saying my name is Michael and I am a stunning alcoholic. And for those listening to the tape, that is a true statement. I look amazing. I do. I look a little chubby, but I still, the neck up has not changed. In fact, I get prettier as I get fatter, and the reason is it blows up, the wrinkles go away. It's true. Now, the fact is, if you announce that you're a cross-addicted alcoholic, same thing. It's irrelevant. The fact that it's true means nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, by the way, Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new or if you're a guest to this, we also don't do things like provide social welfare programs. We don't help you get unemployment or find your housing or let you, you know, worry about how you're going to feed yourself as an institution. However, I myself have I paid for hundreds of dinners. Hundreds. I've paid for hospital bills. I've let people live in my house once for 6 months, another time for a year and a half, a woman with her 15-year-old son. As members, we do extraordinary things that go well beyond the bounds of Alcoholics Anonymous' singleness of purpose. As an institution, as an organization, as a group, we have the singleness of purpose that is what allows the alcoholic to come in and identify. And I'm going to read something very briefly that GSO also sent me. It's called an identification talk, and it was given by a woman named Rosemary P. I believe the reason I continued to come was because I knew I was in the right place. Those people certainly knew, meaning us here in Alcoholics Anonymous, what the drinking game was all about. And I identified very strongly, first with their introduction, because I too admitted that I was an alcoholic. And second, when they spoke of their drinking history, because that's exactly where I was at. Now, every time this room opens and any Alcoholics Anonymous room opens, the members of AA are responsible for the poor person that walks in the door and thinks they have a problem with alcohol. And the reason for that is we tell the world by saying we are an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that that is what we are here to do. And every single time we don't do that, we risk the life of the newcomer that walks through the door. We risk their life. And I honestly had done plenty of that drunk driving. I did plenty of that with abandon for my parents' finances. I did plenty of that before I got here. Once you're here and you want to say that this is what you're part of, your responsibility and the center of your life has changed. And it is to become part of this thing that is called Alcoholics Anonymous. You stay at the door. When you enter here, you become part of us. And by the way, if you become willing to do that, eventually you will have an experience of life that you still is incomprehensible and ununderstandable to the untreated alcoholic. I wish you all a long sobriety. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Melanie.
Hi, I'm Melanie. I'm an alcoholic. What a relief to look out and see so many people I know. I thought I would be nervous, but this isn't so bad. My sobriety date is September 10th, 2010. My sponsor is Lisa R., and I'm very grateful to be her sponsee. She's changed my life in a million ways. I am on step 9, living in 10, 11, and 12. And I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I did not grow up in a family of alcoholics. My parents were both preachers' kids. And my mother, I think I saw her drink a half a glass of wine my whole life. My dad was a social drinker. He was in a bluegrass band. I'm from North Carolina. And on Friday nights, I would go hear him play, and I saw adults drinking. And that was my exposure to alcohol as a child. It looked like a lot of fun. I couldn't wait to try it. I picked up my first drink when I was 15, and I didn't stop really until I got here about 20 months ago. I could have used AA a lot sooner. I'm glad I found it when I did. When I came into this room, this was the second meeting I ever came to. I had literally been hit over the head by the fact that I was an alcoholic. I had bruises on my face. I had a broken tooth. I didn't know how that happened. My last night of drinking, I went out with some people. It was my third night in my new apartment in New York City. If you're new, you'll hear people say in the rooms that God does for us what we can't do for ourselves. And I am so grateful that I hit bottom as quickly as I did in New York, because my experience of New York City has been incredible, and so much love in my life. But I went out with some strangers, and it wasn't fun at all. And I woke up in the hospital, and I didn't know how I got there, and I didn't know what happened to me. And I asked the doctor, and he said the police found me, and I was hurt, and I was sick, and I had a CAT scan, and I have no memory of this at all. And that was enough to finally scare me, and also to open my eyes to the fact that I was an alcoholic. For years, I tried everything to figure out what was wrong with me. I went to therapy. I ran marathons. I went back to school. I did everything I could think of, everything within my grasp to try to fix my life. I was lonely. I had friends. I always had friends. I was always lonely. I felt like I was living my life from behind glass, and everybody else was a part of the world, and I couldn't break that barrier, and I didn't know how to. And I tried relationships. I tried everything I could, and some of those things worked for periods of time. When I was finishing my degree, it was wonderful. I was living in Los Angeles. But then as soon as I was finished, I was left with myself again. And drinking was always there. I was, at that point, a daily drinker, but it was controlled drinking every day. So, you know, only enough to get through my life and make it bearable. But every controlled drink that I had was a promise to really let go at another point. And so I would binge drink, and I would black out. But nothing really bad happened to me. So I couldn't say, oh, you know, I need to stop drinking because bad things are happening to me. I was just miserable and lonely. And so I moved a lot, too. Geographics were one of the things in my toolbox at the time. And about 2 years ago, almost exactly, I decided to move to New York City. I came to visit here. I went out with a friend. I woke up in a relationship with somebody. And my eye hurt, and I had to go to the emergency room. I had a corneal abrasion. Again, I had no idea what happened. And you would think that would be a sign, but I just thought it was funny because I woke up with somebody. And so I don't know that person's name. I never will, probably. I went back to Los Angeles and told my friends all about it. I said, I am so popular in New York City. I can't wait to move there. Insanity. You know, that's the kind of insane thinking that I had. But I remember I would go hiking with one of my friends from school early in the mornings before I left Los Angeles. And those were moments of clarity that I had. And she's a very deeply grounded spiritual person. And I remember thinking, you know, I can't run away from my problems anymore. I have to go to something. And I didn't really have a prayer life or a concept of a higher power or God in my life, but I was getting to that point where I was desperate. And I remember saying, you know, whatever happens when I move to New York, I just want to be a part of life again. And that's what happened. I came here, I hit bottom. It was terrifying to wake up in that hospital room and not know how I'd gotten there, what happened to me. I have a sister who's an alcoholic. She's also sober. She was in the hospital all the time. Things like that happened to her. That's, I think, one reason why I could say, well, that's what alcoholism looks like. On the outside, my life didn't look like hers. But alcoholism on the outside can look like all kinds of things. But on the inside, I was desperate. And then I was really desperate after I woke up in the hospital. And I called a friend in Los Angeles who was sober. And she called a friend of hers in New York. And she brought me to the Atlantic Group's Monday night meditation meeting. And that's another way that God has done for me what I couldn't do for myself. For my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to be at the Atlantic Group, something that I will always be grateful for, because I was immediately picked up and held by all of you. And I didn't have to be alone anymore. It took a while for me to feel a part of. It took some awkward fellowshipping. if you're new and people say, no, you really should fellowship, you really should. It's just a little bit like ripping off a Band-Aid. Once it's off, you start to heal and things get better really quickly. I've met some of my best friends doing service in this program. The love that I have in my life, after less than 2 years in New York City, the amount of people that I know, the amount of abiding relationships that I have in my life, it's incredible, and it wouldn't have happened without AA, and it wouldn't have happened without the Atlantic Group. I had a hard time in my first year avoiding dating. My sponsor suggested that I not do it, and I listened to her, and it was hard, and I did a lot of work around it, but it was worth it. I think I had 15 months, and I met my girlfriend, and she's amazing, and you know what? That's another thing that God has done for me that I couldn't do for myself. I made really poor choices when I was active. I would say, you know, we've all done, I would say, I'm going to do this better next time. I'm going to do this, this, and this. But when you're an AA and you have a sponsor, you actually do those things. You actually follow through on the things that you know are going to be good for you, because you have people in your life who love you and want that for you also. If you're new, keep coming, keep talking to people, answer your phone when people call you. You are lovable, whether you believe it or not. I didn't believe I was lovable by the time I got here. I was covered in shame. Step work will help that. Life gets better, and it gets better dramatically, and it gets better so much faster than you ever could have imagined. So that's all I have for you tonight. Thanks.
Our main speaker for tonight is Myra.
Hi, my name is Myra, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. My sobriety date is January 24th, 1986. My sponsor is Francine W. And as she says, I have not worked the steps, but I am in constant process of working the steps so I can remember to live the steps. And Atlantic Group is indeed my home group. And it is a wonderful, wonderful home group. And I see beautiful faces who I love. I've been on the steering committee second to Peggy in length of time. And I have seen it just grow and progress into a group that I think has a group conscience that we carry the message that Michael so beautifully talked about. And thank you, Melanie, for being the Southern Belle special. This is the Southern Belle special. I'm also from the South. And, you know, particularly, you know, I was thinking about what I was going to start with. And I'm actually going to start with something that happened last week, because it was anniversary night for April last week, and I was in my regular chair that Barry's in. And it was one of those nights, well, first of all, I think our anniversary night is so special. And it just exudes gratitude, even if you're only allowed to speak for 1 minute. It's just amazing to me. And this particular night last week, I don't know, I was more in the now than I usually am, because that's still a challenge for me, even though I do find God in the now. And I don't know if it was because I was thinking about my nephew, who's 20, and who is suffering from the craving, and he can't stop. And I see the toll it's taken, particularly on his father, who is my brother. And he has gone from rehab to rehab to rehab to halfway house, and he's one of these people who cannot even stay. He gets kicked out. And I'm thinking about what it's like to be in a rehab and not even to be able to complete it, you know, for over a year and a half, this process. So I was thinking about him as all the celebrants got up to speak. And I was thinking about, as most of you guys are young, and, you know, you can do the math with me. I thought I was old when I came in here. And boy, and I look back on that, and, you know, I wasn't. But in many ways, as Bob Dylan would say, I was so much older then. I'm younger than that now. But I was, you know, seeing the age here is so young for the most part. And I hope I'm not going to embarrass anybody by saying their names, but I particularly was touched by Duncan. And I have heard him share. I've heard him share about his gratitude and the privilege of being a father and marrying a sober woman who was also in our group, Lisa. And I was sitting there, and I started peeking, and I saw Lisa let her children, orchestrating them beautifully and gently, to go stand by him. These two beautiful girls that he shared with us at that moment. He shared the joy of living, the joy of a sober family. And I immediately thought, wow, this is what God would have us to be. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the fear prayer, it's what I call it. It's a prayer that's in the big book, and it's right before we get into the action of doing our inventory. You know, it's right after the first three steps, which are our foundation, and then it's God, remove my fear and direct my attention as to what you would have me to be. Now, my friend Tara, she says, give freely what you found here, not what you brought here. So what I would have had me to be, what I brought here, would have been a bitter, hardened corpse left to my own devices. Because as Michael pointed out, our primary purpose is to carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers, because it is life or death. And also I was particularly touched by what Gigi had to say when she said she was a stranger to herself. And I related to that. For not only was I a stranger to myself, God, the God that I brought here, was a God that I totally thought was the voice of my higher power. But what I learned here was that it was the voice of my alcoholism. And I just really recently got the enormity of that, that that voice inside my head that I believe was God, that wanted me dead and wanted me miserable, was my alcoholism. And I'm happy to say that's not the God that I found here. So just a little bit of, because I think my message really is in this path of thoroughly following this path. I mean, and I didn't always thoroughly follow it. So if I have a message, you know, it's like I go to this morning meeting and there's two people here from that morning meeting and I heard this guy say this. Now, also, if you like anything that I'm saying, it's not original. It's what I learned here. And, but he was saying, like, you know, doing the steps is like, for the first time, like you're in Paris. And it's just like this amazing, remarkable, beautiful city. And you kind of go in the first restaurant that you come to is McDonald's. And you can stay in McDonald's. And you can be happy thinking I'm in Paris and McDonald's is great. But if you keep on going into continuous and affirmative action, there are so many other restaurants in Paris. So that's what I found in this journey. I through my experience, I learned that this disease is indeed progressive. But through my experience in recovery, I also learned that sobriety is progressive. And not only is sobriety progressive, but honesty is progressive. Openness is progressive. Willingness is progressive. And the good news is the awakenings are progressive. And joy of living is progressive. You know, because at one point in my sobriety that I'll get into, I kind of didn't have the same willingness that I came in with. And so I was comfortable in relief in McDonald's instead of going to that restaurant on top of the Eiffel Tower that I actually later went to in sobriety. So, you know, again, I was content in relief thinking because of where I came from, it was so horrible. I mean, I came from Pepperidge Farm cookies, you know, McDonald's was better. And so, but I then kept on. I was graced with perseverance. But where I came from a southern town, Savannah, Georgia, and I was born Jewish to parents who cherished me and really wanted me. I had three brothers. I was born in the Eisenhower era. And, you know, I do believe I had a predisposition to this disease, but I also believe that I was born in light. I was born as a child of light, and I was born in love. And my yoga teacher says that children, babies are born into a state of Purusha, which is the divine. And so I was in light. And my family wasn't religious, but I remember intuitively having this beautiful God. That, you know, as a kid, it was this big face God that was based on a picture of my grandmother. It was very androgynous. She had red hair and porcelain skin, and she was just beautiful. And that was God. And as a child, I remember being, happy and vibrant and creative. I was very, very creative, and I wrote, produced, directed, and starred in plays, like when I was in sixth grade. And I remember my friends during a reunion told me, and you got us in the paper. So I actually did. I got us in the paper. I later became a publicist, but I didn't even remember that. So, and then when I was about a teenager, my parents went bankrupt. And it was in a small southern town. And, and everybody knew everybody's business. And all the other Jews in our small community were wealthy, but all of a sudden there was this big stigma. Now, the other day I was blessed to hear one of our home group members, Jessica, share. And boy, did she do us proud. Peggy was there, my sponsor was there. And she talked about having this shift in God because she loved God. And when her grandmother died, she had this shift and then started to then question God. Well, that's what happened to me. I was younger, and it was over this trauma in my family. And I remember thinking that there is no God. Even though I was Jewish, I somehow believed pearly gates. And I went, pearly gates? Nah, there's no pearly gates. And I found this diary that I had written when I was about at that age, and I hated myself because I didn't believe in God. I hated myself. So therein began the self-loathing. That was definitely, again, this disease was setting me up. And so I was so lost and in fear, and I didn't share it. I didn't tell anybody. And I do remember, like, Bill read that doggerel in the cemetery. I read a newspaper article about a girl my age who had died in a car accident. And I remember thinking, oh, she's so lucky she got it over with. And that is not what a normal 12-year-old thinks. So set up the first drink maybe a few years later, and boy, did I feel relief. All those dark thoughts, all those fears, they just seemed to be quieted. And I was part of a group. I could sort of fit in, you know, and I just felt different. I felt relief. You know, and at about that same time, too, I went on this Geographic that my parents sort of, you know, programmed me to believe that this was I was going to go to New York because they had a friend there who had a daughter my age. So I was going to go on this great trip to New York. Unfortunately, I took my fear with me. And again, I hadn't shared it with them. So the friend that they had in New York who had a daughter my age, she happened to have been friends with the guy who was bringing the Beatles to New York. So I was going to get to see the Beatles. Now, anybody, you know, who watches Mad Men, they had that great scene where, my God, there was the Beatles were like it. They were all that. But me, in my fear of God hating me, was convinced. And I know you people get me. I know you people believe me. I was convinced that I was going to die that night, that I was going to see the Beatles, and that God was going to kill me for not believing in him. And I was so convinced that I wouldn't even sit in the death seat, in the front seat. Now, I'm a people pleaser. My girlfriend wanted me to sit in the front seat. I said, no, back seat. Holding on, thinking, okay, when am I going to be killed? I mean, it's so sad. But there I was. I'm at Shea Stadium. The Beatles are screaming. I did allow myself to use the binoculars and see Ringo's rings. But I'm in that heart-thumping fear, thinking I'm going to be killed on the way back. And when I wasn't, I'm just sharing this because it opened me up to maybe believe that there was a higher power. Maybe there is something, excuse me, out there. And I called it a life force. You know, I just made it up. And let me just take a sip instead of fighting it. Ah, water. So I was like, when I didn't die, then I started to, okay, there is some kind of life force. How to find it? Therein lies the journey. I can tell you how it wasn't to be found, and it wasn't on the journey that I then decided to partake, because indeed, drugs are in my story. So I don't want to get into a drunkologue. I really, really don't. Just sometimes people have said that, and then they get into the drunkologue. So I'm not going to. I'm going to stop myself because it really doesn't matter how I got here. But I was trying in my own way, and that's what it says in the big book, to find some sort of higher power. So I progressed. I moved to New York on another Geographic, and, you know, I got into the nightlife. I loved to boogie right away. And, you know, I mean, what a dream job. I worked at Studio 54. I was the assistant to the owner. You know, I had arrived, but I wasn't, it just wasn't happening for me. I wasn't happy. I mean, I remember being introduced to the most celebrated people in the world, and something inside me just was just, you know, it wasn't joy of living. I thought I was going to find it, but I didn't. I just couldn't find it. So my disease progressed, and finally, you know, I recognized at first that I had a problem with drugs, and I went to my first 12-step meeting. I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol. No, not me. You know, no, no. I thought I had, but I recognized I had this other problem, and I remember going to my first 12-step meeting. And see, it was another fellowship, but I thought I had power, and I thought my life was manageable. And I go to this meeting, and I'm looking at, you know, it was a small meeting in Savannah because my parents had taken me in while I tried to, you know, get better. And they loved me unconditionally. I'm really blessed. Just like my brother loves his son, my parents loved me unconditionally and didn't understand what I was going through, but they accepted me. And I'm in this meeting, and I'm thinking, we people are a glum lot, you know. And then there was a girl with 7 years. She hasn't had anything for 7 years. She doesn't have a problem. And so by the time the sharing got to me, you know, you people, I had all power. I was going to quote Conan the Barbarian. I was going to quote from him, that which does not kill you makes you stronger. And I really believed that. Like, I really believed my life was pretty good and that, you know, I had power. I had power to say no. I believed that. So, needless to say, they told me, as soon as I get to New York, call somebody, go to meetings. Not me. No, I didn't want what they had. I was on my own. I knew how to do it. Well, lo and behold, I wind up at my friend's apartment with a bottle of scotch in front of me. And I was drinking that scotch not to go out and party. I was drinking that scotch to kill that horrible feeling inside me, that withdrawal feeling. And for without that bottle of scotch inside me, I was in panic and terror. And with that bottle of scotch inside me, I was in self-pity and resentment. And that was the quality of my life. And I realized I hated scotch. And so I had that epiphany, that moment that it talks about in our book, that is the first step in recovery, where I admitted to myself, oh my God, I'm an alcoholic too. I had that information. I had that inside me. I wish I could say I called AA right then and there, but I didn't. I progressed, and the disease had me, and I didn't know I had a choice, and I was dying. My brother got a call a few months later. This was after my grandfather had passed away, and I remember going down to the funeral. And my family was in such denial that they thought I was just tired. You know, they didn't realize I was completely in a zombie state of where that disease takes us, in a phase where we are physically dying. I was physically dying, and my family could not help me. Except my brother got this call from a friend and said, Myra's got about a week to live. You should come up here and get her. And it was about that time that I had quit my job, because my boss wanted me to get off the phone. I'll show you, I'll quit. And, you know, I did. I didn't have a plan B. Myra did not have a plan B. Maybe I was in a little bit of trouble here. Like, I had this roommate. He was this really nice banker, and he thought he was paying half the rent. His share was $600. My share was $25. And I had just spent his rent. So I kind of didn't have a plan B, but my brother came to offer me that there was this bed for me at Georgia Mental Health Institute, and maybe I should go there. Might be a good idea. I had two requirements. A, would he pay my rent? And B, you know, can I go the next day? Because I knew I had a paycheck left, and I wanted to, you know, spend the paycheck. So he said, okay, and he left, and he went back to Atlanta. And his friend said I would never show up. Why did he leave me? But, you know, I did. I got on that plane because, again, I didn't have a plan B. And I actually thought my life was manageable. I thought, I'm doing okay. Got my brother to pay the rent. You know, I'm just going to go to this little place. I just have a physical problem, and I just need to kind of just get this out of my system and then return to New York and conquer it and do what I was doing, which was never leave my apartment. So I checked into a Georgia Mental Health Institute on that winter day. I had left New York in a little flimsy coat, in denial of everything, in denial of weather, in denial of shoe size, in denial. And I check in Georgia Mental Health, and my brother made me lie about what drugs I was on. But I lied about how much I had to drink because I didn't want you to find out I was an alcoholic. No, 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 not that. I would not give that up. You people, maybe I'd have to give up the other, but not alcohol. I couldn't live. I couldn't live without alcohol. How was I going to sleep at night? What was going to happen when my parents died? I'll do this part, but they cannot find out I'm an alcoholic. So I went there belligerent. And I was so lonely at that point in my life. And the people had dwindled, and I was around the bottom feeders, that I had a silent scream inside my head that I could verbalize in my apartment, and nobody was there to hear it. And so when I get to Georgia Mental Health Institute, and there's three other women in the room with me, you know, it's not so bad, because I really was lonely, and I didn't even know I was lonely. But all of a sudden, there's these three other women, and, you know, I thought, okay, this is going to be okay. This is going to be okay. And then the one with no teeth, she stole my peanut brittle. She stole my peanut brittle. I call my brother, get me out of here. This is not fun. He said, Myra, this isn't supposed to be fun. That got my attention. What? I had this preconceived notion that life was supposed to be fun and that, you know, but me, I was the victim. I was the drama queen victim that, you know, nothing was happening for me. And that, you know, it was all me against the world. So I also met this guy there who had been to 40 rehabs. I hooked on to him. He was a winner. He knew the ropes, you know, and again, that was my thinking. Now, there was a counselor there named Cindy. And I sort of knew she had my number, so I wanted to avoid Cindy. Even she led the groups. I didn't want her to, you know, have any kind of confrontation with me. But also another significant thing happened. We were playing cards, and this guy said, he's cheating. And this other girl said, hey, it's okay to cheat in a mental institution. And I said, what? Where am I? I'm in a mental institution? What are you talking about? This is a detox. I just have a physical problem. But that got my attention. So there I was in this circle of people with Cindy, and I was going to fix the person next to me because she had a boyfriend. I was telling her you had to get rid of that boyfriend. And, you know, I had the answers. I was like, I don't know, 14 days sober. And all of a sudden, the focus was on me. Cindy just kind of put that little flashlight on me, and I just remember wanting to die. I just wanted to be anonymous. I didn't want anybody to know who I was or what I was. I just wanted to return to New York, get money from my brother, and do what I was doing, which, again, was never leaving my apartment, but that was my thinking, and I was belligerent. And Cindy, all of a sudden, she looked at me, and she said it, like this. What's it like to be a 34-year-old junkie, Myra? Yeah, and I remember thinking to myself, I'm 35, you little beep. See, I look younger. Michael, I thought I was stunning. I really did. I really did. And I remember there was a 19-year-old boy there named Alan, and there was a woman my age, which was 35, named Rose, who was a grandmother. So I'm thinking, I'm going to get a compliment. Alan, who looks better, me or Rose? And Alan said to me, he says, Myra, you look like you've been rode hard and put up wet. Oh, yeah, and then I got contacts, and I really, oh, my God. So Cindy, all of a sudden, she says this to me, and I answer her, I am belligerent. And then the next thing she said to me, she said, is your brother your back door, Myra? Whoa, what happened to me then? And I'm really so blessed and so fortunate. And this doesn't happen for everybody, so if you're new, just It will eventually. You might have the educational variety. But for me, I had a surrender. I had a palatable moment where the weight of the world was lifted from my shoulders, and I surrendered and admitted complete defeat. And what I have learned in my experience was that I worked the first step perfectly at that moment. And what that means is I didn't feel guilt, remorse, or shame. I felt relief, just like I had when I picked up that drink and all my fears went away. I felt the relief that the weight of the world was lifted and I did not have to do it my way anymore. And the miracle of that moment was that I knew I was going to die and that I wanted to live. And it was my bottom. I wanted to live. And the next thing I saw, the next thing she said to me was, "Do you surrender to the guidance and direction of others?" So I said, "Tell me what to do." So then I worked the steps. I did what you people told me to do. I went to a halfway house. I stayed till I had a foundation. And I worked the steps as best I could. But it wasn't until I returned to New York and I found a sponsor who taught me the big book and the way of the big book that I truly began the process of awakening. I was content in relief. I was content in McDonald's. I thought I worked the steps. I'm waiting for the spiritual awakening. I guess I'm going to have to sponsor people. This was before caller ID, but I didn't have joy of living. Now, I've heard it said that the big book is a textbook. But to me, you know, I went to college, a textbook was something I read, took the test, and then left. The big book is a lifeline. And when I comprehended what the word thorough means, because today my sobriety has dramatically shifted in the past few years, I was content again with happiness and you know, going up the scale, getting stuff, and that would fix me. But I didn't have the joy of living. I got the joy of living, again, by being thorough. The keys for me were prayer and meditation. When I started to meditate daily, when I quieted my voice, and I can recognize my alcoholism today. I can hear it. It's distinct. It's not my higher power, and it's lying to me. But it is a daily reprieve. Time is a magazine. If there was a microphone to my thoughts, nobody would be my friend. You know, and it's just a matter of how I work the steps and how I begin the process of letting go. How I begin the six and seven, four and five, when I did it by the big book, you know, I got how to do 8 and 9. But 6 and 7 were key. I had to get out of the picture in order to do 8 and 9. Today, 6 and 7 are so vital. They're vital to me. I mean, I've had awakenings with particularly this brother who wasn't a big proponent of AA. He didn't understand why I still went to meetings. And yet, you know, I worked on letting go. I worked on coming from a compassionate place, seeing him, seeing his stuff, not making it about me. And I can do that in all of my life today with other people. You know, I hear that that's God. That is the God that I found here, a God who loves me unconditionally. I did not bring that God. You people taught me. 8 and 9 was an incredible journey. It was really and truly where the beginning of the end of isolation between man and God. I've learned that the first three steps, they're not a decision. The first three steps begin the process for the action of 4 through 12. And it is in 4 through 12 that I found the God of my understanding, the God that you people showed me. I didn't get it right from the first three steps, but I got it enough to be in continuous and affirmative action and to know what I'm not. And so today, the awakening continues. The awakening is progressive to where I get. When I do the work, when I do the thorough part, when I ask those questions at night, was I kind and loving towards all? Am I packing it into the stream of life? Or am I thinking about what I can do for others? If I can think about what I can do for others, I can have joy of living. But therein lies, that's the journey, is recognizing that as the true joy of living. So I'm so grateful for my sobriety, and I love you all in my home group. Thank you.